grew up in a nice neighborhood, but it didn't do her no good. Cause she's just a sum of her influence, and I can't tell you the difference by the cracked windscreen on her car. Stunning and telling you that how lucky you are. You're just like the rest of those girls.
Well, hello. My name is Tom Chick, and you are listening... Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I cut you off. Let's try that again, take two.
I know, sorry, McMaster.
Alright. Hello, my name is Tom Chick.
And I'm Jason McMaster.
And you are listening... Oh, you know what, let's do that.
With Barbershop Quartet, I think a harmony would probably be the way to go about.
No, JT, you have totally the right idea. Let's do take three, and then JT get in here. So here we go. Hello, my name is Tom Chick.
And I'm Jason McMaster.
And I'm Jason Townsend.
And we are bringing you the Quarter to Three Games Podcast. That was smooth, gentlemen. Normally, we would have wanted to introduce you, Jason Townsend, or JT. Can we call you JT, by the way?
You may.
Because it's going to get very confusing. I feel outnumbered by Jason's on this podcast.
We actually have McCullough waiting in the wings. He's
That would be... And then we'll get Jason Cross in here.
Yep.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So let's see. We're going to meet JT, Jason Townsend, before we go into our format, because, JT, you, I understand, are from a foreign land.
I am indeed. I am a Canadian.
And you live in Halifax, which I love saying, by the way.
It is. Is it a fun place? It's a fun place to say. There was a Daily Show segment a little while about whether it should be Halifax or Hoalifax.
Why would it be the other? Oh, because you guys are so friendly?
Well, no, it was because it was discovered to be the new holiest place in both Judaism and Islam.
So, Halifax?
Yes, Halifax, Nova Scotia.
That makes no sense to me.
I'll append the Earl at the end of the podcast.
Okay. So Halifax is in Nova Scotia. What is Nova Scotia like? Is it all, like, wintry and there's fishermen everywhere?
It's actually pretty similar to New England, this same sort of climate. People like the fall foliage, and it is quite scenic in the rural areas.
Now, JT, you would probably appreciate this. When I woke up this morning, it was freezing cold. In my house, the temperature read 65 degrees.
So it's actually extremely hot, 65 degrees. That's like Saudi Arabia on a bad day.
No, I had to like put on a jacket and everything. It was untenable.
Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking. I'm not doing any crazy metric stuff, JT. Just so you know. You're from there. It's home. You're born and raised in Halifax, Nova Scotia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that means you speak French natively, right?
It means I speak French very poorly. It's part of primary education, but it does tend to fall off a little bit from disuse if you don't employ it in everyday life.
We actually, before we recorded, we heard a little of your French, and I can back you up that you do speak it poorly.
Thank you. That's kind of you to say.
Now, you are a former student. You're doing the whole, like, what do I do now that I'm not a student anymore kind of thing, correct?
I am.
What you studied, by the way, and I thought this was very curious, as soon as you mentioned it, you and McMaster began an animated and erudite conversation.
Well, we are animated and erudite fellows.
So true.
And now, this conversation was about what?
It was about Erich von Manstein, who was a German field marshal and the subject of my master's thesis.
And the founder of Mannheim Steamroller, right?
Right.
I believe so, yes. It was one of his less known...
It's a beautiful work.
So you mentioned this in the context of talking about, I think you said something about people with Wehrmacht penis envy?
Indeed. That was a phrase that was coined a number of decades ago by political science and history people to describe the tendency of historians and some people in the sort of the military sciences to sort of romanticize or exaggerate the Wehrmacht's particular accomplishments in the Second World War.
And is that basically just because they were so incredibly bold and audacious with what they were trying? Or what? Why is that? Why don't people have that towards, say, the Italian armed forces?
Well, I mean, the Italian armed forces is kind of its own special case. And actually, people that do World War II history about the Italian army would actually tell you, wait, there are interesting things you must know. But with the German army, well, there's no question about the overall numbers, but a lot of it did have to do with Italy's poor preparedness in terms of its, like, political economy of war. If you don't have weapons, then
what happens when you run it like a mob country, an army like a mob instead of, like,
With the German army, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the German army, actually, their generals went to work for the American army immediately after the Second World War closed with the U.S. Army Historical Division. So there's Wehrmacht generals essentially writing the history of World War II for the benefit of the U.S. Army. And they essentially came to kind of set the tone for a lot of Cold War era military historiography. Mm-hmm. So people began to kind of accept the idea that the bold German Wehrmacht had, been using its military proficiency and training to hold off the, you know, vastly superior numbers of the Soviet Union and the mm-hmm. Western Allies combined, which, you know, has a certain irreducible truth to it, but it kind of was essentially spun the Wehrmacht's way. And so that trend has kind of persisted, especially with a lot of sort of History Channel pop history of the Second World War.
Now, with this knowledge, with your own Wehrmacht penis envy that got you through school,
I would say that I don't consider myself a sufferer.
You do not. So, what sets you apart then from people who have Wehrmacht penis envy? Come on, so much about this.
I would say that I'm not. Not to necessarily suggest that the Wehrmacht wasn't didn't have the most successful, you know, statistical proficiency in the Second World War.
They lost the war.
They did indeed.
Yes.
But the Wehrmacht penis envy thing is more a matter of exaggerating German prowess and proficiency and mm-hmm. putting it in laudatory or exaggerated terms.
How many games do you have installed on your hard drive right now that have hexes?
Gosh, actual hexes.
Is it double-digit numbers?
I would have to count Civ 5.
You would?
I would say probably 4 or 5.
Okay. You then need to hang out with Bruce Garrick, by the way.
I don't consider myself in the Bruce Garrick league of Grognard Wargamers, but... I know some of the basics.
No, I would love to throw you, and now that I know McMaster, you said you had a roommate that studied all this stuff, so from osmosis. Oh,
that's all we talked about, basically, for years.
McMaster, who's your favorite German general?
Rommel.
Yeah.
But he's a different thing. I like Rommel.
Is it correct to say that Rommel is the sexiest German general?
Well, he did have quite the striking figure, yes.
He had a real PR machine, and of course the British wound up playing a lot of that up as well, in part because of it made the Eighth Army look better.
Yeah, it did.
Beaten by the best. Mm-hmm.
JT, what level are you in Hearts of Iron 3?
Okay.
I do not own Hearts of Iron 3. Because
wait a minute. What? Yeah.
I was such a big fan of the second game that the idea of automating things and taking a more hands-off approach to the game did not appeal to me at all.
You know what? Based on that, let's jump ahead real quick to your post of the week. We're for the podcast, we're going to do a post of the week, a game of the week, and a news story of the week. But now that you have mentioned that you're not a fan of Hearts of Iron 3, JT, I want you to tell us what your post of the week is, because I think this will segue into something I want to talk about.
Well, it is Paradox related because mm-hmm. it was Brian Rucker's post in the Are You Fan Enough for Crusader Kings 2 thread. And he had reposted essentially something that Johan A. from Paradox had posted on their forums. But it was quite excellent, and it was essentially a mini AAR from Crusader Kings 2. And it says, I was playing CK2 this afternoon to see how the new event series is working out. It turned out brilliantly fun, and I had to share with you guys. Started off as Conan, Duke of Brittany, did my usual tactic of da-da-da-da-da, and it goes into great detail. I was slowly building up my economy, fiddling about with what upgrades to go, when my bastard half-brother Jeffrey asked me for a wife.
I hate Jeffrey.
Sorry.
And he goes... and goes about finding a young woman called named Tumas Dudal in my court. A few months later, my slightly annoying brother bothers me again. He claims his wife is cheating on him. Since I have a trusting trait, I dismiss him, saying nothing happened. Then Tumas becomes very happy with me. So happy, she gets a little bit later, she flirts, and one thing happens leads to another, and a few months later, her belly starts growing. At the same time, my wife gives birth to my hair and Benoit, but a duke can only be too careful, and children tend to die of lots of natural causes. So, at any rate, he goes on and legitimizes his bastard son, and his various legitimate and illegitimate sides of his family commence to kill each other off and have murder plots against one another.
So it sounds like you are looking forward to, like, the fact that you would pick this out as your post of the week. I presume you are at least intrigued by Crusader Kings 2, but you, for whatever reason, have no desire to play Hearts of Iron 3. Is that correct?
That is correct. And part of it is I find there's a lot of appeal and added value to the sort of thing you get in the Total War series or in Crusader Kings, where there are a whole bunch of little characters within a strategy game, mm-hmm. and they can sort of, without a whole lot of fleshing out on the part of the game itself, can kind of provide a little micro history, often a very interesting and kind of amusing one.
Mm-hmm. And so then what's the problem with Hearts of Iron 3, which you just mentioned briefly before, but I want you to elaborate.
Well, Hearts of Iron 3, as best I understood it, tried to deal with some of the micromanagement problems that had come up. And I mean, Hearts of Iron 2 had simplified on certain aspects of Hearts of Iron 1 as well. But the things which were abstracted in Hearts of Iron 3 just seemed to be things that I enjoyed. And so I thought Hearts of Iron 2 had basically struck the appropriate balance of micromanagement for what I wanted to play.
There's the Paradox games have so much in common, but for this basic kind of game that Paradox does, Hearts of Iron 3 and Crusader Kings 1 and by extension Crusader Kings 2 are kind of like the opposite ends of the spectrum for various reasons. And I'm with you 100% JT. Like, I have no desire to play the Hearts of Iron game, specifically 3. It's completely lost me, but I am so incredibly psyched for Crusader Kings 2. I love what they've done there. And I just love that both of those games come from the same company. I love that Paradox is out there doing that stuff.
It is neat that Paradox is able to apparently make a business model work while still releasing games. Like, Victoria 2 is another excellent example of a game that somehow exists amazingly with this unusual model of economy and populations.
Where do you fall on Victoria 2?
I only owned Victoria 1, and I tried to play it, and I just... For one thing, I wasn't good at it, and for another thing, I couldn't quite get into it. I've always had trouble with economies which are a little bit too market-driven and dependent on emergent developments. Mm-hmm. I had a real problem with Civ 3 in that at the time when I played it, a lot of it seemed to depend on selling technologies to AIs to use them to fund your own research, mm-hmm. which to me, it kind of felt like I was playing poker against AIs and figuring out how much I could sucker them. And that wasn't exactly the way that I wanted to boom an economy.
Well, you should try Victoria 2 at some point. I mean, I know it's kind of hard to recommend.
Well, it looks impressive. It's certainly a game that I would consider.
And they've what they tried to do in Victoria 1, and I didn't play Victoria 1, so I can't speak with much authority, but I understand they really did finesse a lot of what they were trying to do there in 2. And I think 2 is just such a unique gameplay model that a guy like you should definitely at least see it. So,
2 right. just came out, didn't it? Recently?
Victoria 2? Oh, McMaster, you are so behind the times. 2 has actually been out for, I don't know, how long has it been out, JT? I want to say a year.
Yeah, it's not ancient news. I think what's happening is there's...
I saw it on Steam recently. That's what it is. That's DLC. Yeah.
Yeah, but so... McMaster, for you, Victoria 2, I'm not so sure I'd recommend it.
Well, I wouldn't play it, so yeah, probably not a good one.
All right, so we're in accord there. All right, so that was JT's post of the week. McMaster, what do you have for post of the week, by the way?
For me, it was actually an entire thread I'm finding pretty interesting, and it's the one with a guy you know actually is posting in it, Casper. You remember Casper, right? I assume.
I know him as Brian, but Brian Casp is a good friend of mine from L.A. who moved to Prague.
Right.
He's an actor there, and I just now saw him in a PlayStation commercial, by the way.
Yeah, he's in the thread, too, but it's the thread, the Two Michael thread, which is for that commercial.
Oh.
And what is fascinating about it, the name of the thread, by the way, is Two Michael, Sony reminds us they take gaming seriously. And what I find interesting about that thread overall is that where people fall on the are they embarrassed by their hobby or not? Because a lot of people are like, oh, that commercial, so it's awful, it's embarrassing. And a lot of people really liked it. You know, I like it, but at the same time, it doesn't bother me that I'm a gamer. That's pretty much what I do.
Did you call your wife in to see the commercial, Jason McMaster?
I think I did show it to her last night, actually, yeah.
All right. JT, are you embarrassed by the commercial, and have you seen it?
I have seen the commercial. It wasn't so much that I was embarrassed. I did find it perhaps a little bit much in that it was sort of an earnest love letter from Sony to how amazingly awesome games are and that sort of thing.
I mean, well, it's a little maudlin or whatever, but, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not that, like, you're upset about the fact that, you know, they're showing gaming and being real serious about it.
I mean, it works as humor if you find it over the top anyway. So,
certainly
not something I thought. Oh, this is a terrible ad. It was creative.
No, it's absolutely.
I was struck by the fact that they weren't all Sony exclusives.
Yeah, I thought it was a little weird too.
Yeah, I thought it was smart because I mean, it works better as a joke and a cultural reference if you're not just trotting out the Sony exclusives.
Yeah, but the Sony exclusives are so prominent that it seems to me a little odd that they would start off with all these Sony exclusives. Although, I guess whatever generic World War II thing starts it, I'm not sure what that's supposed to be. But once you have, like, Nathan Drake, Kratos, I forget what the other, the infamous guy, you know, you lead with that stuff, and then we trickle in the non-exclusives.
They had Sweet Tooth, too.
Yeah, exactly. And those are all, these are all going to be, this is the bar of Sony exclusives. and then Altair comes in and various other non-exclusives. And you're like, oh.
I saw a portal on the back wall, and that was when I realized it wasn't all Sony exclusives.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was hugely, I mean, I can't really say whether or not, I thought it was a little silly, but I was hugely pleased to see my friend Brian get the prominent role as the barkeep. And I actually emailed him afterwards, and I was like, I don't understand what character you were. I got all of the other ones, but what game has a scarred barkeep? And he's like, oh. And he sort of said, well, they just imagined that, you know, if there was a barkeep in the Sony universe, that's what it would be. So people in the thread sort of discussing whether or not they're embarrassed by their hobby. That was the point of it, McMaster?
Yeah. I just always find it interesting when people are upset by gaming or whatever. People, you know, finding things in, you know, taking things seriously because, I don't know, I've spent a lot of time playing games and, you know, there's been a lot of memories, a lot of reactions I've had from that, so.
I would say, as for the issue of whether or not you should be embarrassed by your hobby, I would say a couple of factors come into play. Namely, what game is it that you're playing? And should you be embarrassed by that? For instance, I'm embarrassed by my hobby when I'm playing Rage. What do you think of that, McMaster?
Oh, God.
I am not embarrassed by my hobby when I'm playing Crusader Kings. So there.
Yeah.
I think with me it would be more contextual, and I don't know. I don't feel obliged to fly my gamer flag under all social circumstances. So if I'm talking with people that are plausibly gamers, I certainly am not shy about it. But I don't strike up a random conversation with someone on a bus.
Well, sure. No, I mean you gotta just kind of assume that. Not everybody's going to be a game player. That's just like a normal person thing. I don't think, I mean, you have to be kind of like, no, I better just quiet down now. Never mind.
Well, no, I would. I think it is worth saying that people ought not have a complex about it as if it's a secret, shameful hobby or anything like that. There certainly is a regrettable tendency to take things too far in that direction.
I mean, we're not talking about the SCA, for God's sakes. We're talking about... Just kidding.
What's wrong with SCA?
See,
how dare you?
Yeah.
Our meetings are completely open. I mean, we're not ashamed. I have my fake set of armor right in here.
I know you do.
I'm making in my garage. I'm making an all new Morningstar.
You're girding your loins.
My loins are so girded, you would not believe.
Oh God.
JT, do you know what SCA stands for? Here's a test for you.
Well, on the basis of Morningstars and armor, I'm thinking it's perhaps some kind of a Ren Faire-related thing.
I love the way you pretend you don't know what it is. Well done. Well done, James.
Oh, actually, you know what? I do know exactly what it is. That's the Society for Creative Anachronism.
Yeah, see, we outed you. You were going to pretend, it sounds interesting. I don't know what it is. And then we outed you. All right.
No, well, I had heard of it, but did I get it? Creative is correct?
No, very good. Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah. All right, so there we go. Those are our posts of the week. Jason R. McMaster, I'm going to use your middle initial to set you apart from JT here to avoid confusion. What are we going to do next? Where are we going to go from our posts of the week, Jason R. McMaster?
I don't know. Let's switch it up. How about you pick, Tom? You pick.
Let's do our news story of the week, starting with you, Jason R. McMaster. What League of Legends related news do you have to bring us this week?
No, I figured we could take a little time to talk about Steve Jobs.
Oh, that's sad. Way to bring the room down.
Good old Steve. I'm just doing this for Andy Bates.
Why are you doing this for Andy Bates?
It'd make him feel good.
Why did he feel good that Steve Jobs died?
No, he's a big Apple fan. I'm trying to, I'm trying to make him feel better.
It's not like rubbing it in or something.
No.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us what the news is? Let's pretend that people listening to the podcast don't have internet or whatever, in which case I don't know how they're listening. But what happened in Apple-related news this week, Jason R. McMaster?
They released the new iPad. something like that. But no.
I'm a terrible person for laughing at that.
No. Steve Jobs passed away.
At age 57, I want to say?
I want to say 56, yeah.
Yeah, and the cause of death, of course, not technically announced, but presumably related to pancreatic cancer.
All right.
Jason R. McMaster, what will the enduring legacy of Steve Jobs be?
What?
Am I even saying his name right? Is it really Jobs?
I think it is Jobs.
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Jobs. Steve Jobs.
So I blame two things. I read most of my news. That's one of the things. And the other thing, yeah, is I studied the Old Testament in college. So Jason R. McMaster, what is Steve Jobs' enduring legacy?
Well, it depends. He was quite a prolific mofo. His enduring legacy, of course, is the Apple Corporation and the Macintosh, the iPhone, the iPad. Mm-hmm. Et cetera, the iMac. Very interesting guy, very technically creative. Kind of interesting.
The renaissance of the company within the industry certainly owes a lot to his sort of dramatic return as well.
Oh, no, I would absolutely say that it owes it all to his dramatic return. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't design the iPod himself, but he brought the guys in and he oversaw it, so, it's a shame, and Gates didn't kill him after all.
I think we should announce a one-week moratorium on making fun of people who game on Macs in honor of Steve Jobs.
That seems fair.
Yep.
Uh-oh.
JT, do you have something to share?
No, it would be in poor taste to veto that.
Okay. I thought you were going to confess that you have, Mac with a boot camp and that's how you play Civ 5 or whatever.
No, I wasn't really sure about the idea.
All right, well, we'll put you down for an abstention, whereas Jason R. McMaster and I are voting for the moratorium. No making fun of people who game on Macs, who are very proud of the fact that their Diablo 2 discs work in their Mac directly.
Oh, yes.
You, You guys get a week off from...
Did that come out in, what, like 2005?
There are plenty of games you can play on a Mac.
No, that World came Warcraft. Out in 2001, maybe, something like that. That was a long time ago. In 2005, though, was
it? The Endurance?
I was just being a jerk.
Oh, okay.
All right, so news of the week from Jason R. McMaster, bringing us down. Steve Jobs dead at 56. Very sad. JT, can you bring the room up with your news of the week?
Well, it would probably depend on how one defines bring the room up, and I don't want to unduly get into things that you might want to talk about at a later date, but the story that interested me most was the reception of Rage and its release.
Well, go ahead. What is the reception of Rage? Because I consider myself... I'm actually fairly insulated from a lot of this stuff. I got a review copy of Rage, I played it, and I reviewed it, and that was pretty much it. I haven't seen a lot of the reviews. My editor didn't have an embolism when I submitted my review, which gave it a D. I did not care for the game. I mainly have been griefing J.R. McMaster, because I know he has already chosen Rage as his game of the decade.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Game of the millennia.
So, JT, break down for us. What kind of reception is Rage getting? What is the actual news?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the reception is sort of broken down in interesting ways. The larger organs, at least as of the time when I last checked, were giving it quite good reviews. There were some 9.5s, things of that nature. There were also some sort of catastrophically bad reviews. Most notably, Ars Technica came out with a quite scathing review that more or less, I don't know, declared it to be somewhere near Duke Nukem Forever, perhaps with a little bit more merit. And that, of course, is immediately turned into a discussion point of its own. Was this Ars Technica review fair? That sort of thing. But the other thing is the console release has gone a lot more smoothly than the PC release, which appears to have been a bit of a fiasco, actually, especially for people on ATI cards, which is sort of a familiar news story, I guess, but it was pretty severe. My follow-up, if I couldn't use my original post of the week, I was going to use Tim James's post from the quarter to three thread on Rage, which is, for those playing at home, the PC version looks awesome standing still unless you're dealing with a driver bug.
Wow.
The idea being that there's a terrible texture pop-in problem where there was, I guess particularly with ATI cards, where if you just panned the view to the side by about 60 degrees, the textures went from its normal, quite gorgeous actually, ideal, to what looks like maybe a 2001 game with these extremely blunt textures. So it was a very severe texture pop-in problem.
So two things. The solution there, just don't pan your view 60 degrees. And second of all, this is a common mistake, but his name is actually Jim James.
Oh, yeah. No, there was a typo there.
So have you seen Rage, JT?
I have seen only via, high-definition videos and that sort of thing on the internet. It does look quite attractive in terms of the skybox is unusually lovely looking. Mm-hmm. And certainly the shades of brown are looking as pleasant as shades of brown do.
Will you play a game like Rage? Is that in your wheelhouse?
I think if I had a console, which I do not, I would probably consider it for a rental, because actually there were people on the quarter to three thread whose opinion I respect who were saying that essentially the man-shoot components of the game actually worked reasonably well. The one thing that I noticed from the videos is you could tell that it used weak guns, which is to say the enemies take a number of shots to die, even if they're shot in the head, which isn't something that I really care for in an FPS. But I guess in terms of, I don't know, encounter design and everything except for the save and checkpoint system, the driving and the shooting seem to be getting fairly positive response.
McMaster, how do you feel about all that?
Well, I'm very fond of the driving and the shooting. I mean, I agree, but I'm not fancy pants.
Well,
Well, Mr. Mundane Pants, what platform are you playing on, by the way? Are you on the 360 or the PC?
Yeah, 360.
Okay. And I have to say, on the 360, I had some reservations about it. Technically, I think it's fine. I have had no problems. I'm surprised that there is none of that, like, texture melt-in that some of the early Gears games suffered from, Halo certainly. Both Gears 3 and Rage, I think, have adapted themselves very nicely to the 360's hardware.
Gears 3 is one of the nicest-looking consoles. I mean, not Gears 3, but Rage is one of the nicest-looking console games I've ever seen.
Now, one of the things that was speculated on was that it might have had something to do with the fact that panning using a console controller is sometimes a little bit more gradual than with a mouse, although it seemed like the PC problem might have been more driver-related. I should also have said that a lot of people had problems of the game won't start running variety.
Yeah, Bill's having that problem.
So, McMaster... I was joking before when I said that you would call it your game of the decade. You actually only said it would be your game of the year. So you are digging it, right? Like, my contention is that pretty much everything that JT has said, that people who speak approvingly about the game, like that the man-shoot component is good, I disagree with all that. I think that the shooting is just terrible. I think the interface is terrible. Technically, I think it looks fine, but from an aesthetic perspective, I think it is one tired-ass game. There's nothing that they are drawing here that I haven't seen done better elsewhere. I'm going to go on record as being a huge detractor of Rage, and I think it's a colossal disappointment from a design perspective. And JT, not even worth your time to rent. That would be my official recommendation. McMaster, tell me I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
Well done. Well played.
Thank you.
the Couture review on Ars Technica that was.
Oh, it's Ben Couture.
Yeah,
it was, way to shoot yourself in the foot, JT.
it was really actually focused more on things that were a little bit similar to the sort of little interesting things that Tom didn't like post, which a lot of them were sort of, this is a really stupid concept, this is a really dumb design decision, this is not well thought out, and so that was kind of able to coexist with people in the forum saying, well, yeah, but it was just fun, in quotation marks.
But, and I want to point out real quick also, and McMaster, sorry, I'll let you get in here a second. That thing that I posted on the front page literally was deleted bits from my notes that I didn't feel were worth mentioning in the review. The review's now posted at GameShark, but all that stuff I mentioned, I really hope that folks didn't think that I cared overly about those things. Those were such minor points. So on the larger point of even is the driving, is the shooting good, that stuff I feel is awful. So I was just getting warmed up with that little list of deleted bits from my notes. So I'm sorry, I cut you off, J.R. McMaster. What were you going to say?
Well, saying that it's like Duke Nukem Forever is insane.
Which I agree with, by the way. I do agree with that. It's more technically, Duke Nukem Forever had a lot of technical shortcomings. It seemed like that they couldn't put a lot. It's like Duke Nukem Forever, but with polish. That's where I would actually go that far.
I don't believe that I actually pulled that quote from anywhere. That was just sort of a paraphrasing, because that was the impression that I got, which is to say that the design choices were not appreciated by the reviewer, and I think there was a sense that there was inspiration and I don't know, QA missing.
I don't know. I feel the game. I feel it looks good. It controls well, and I don't know. I've enjoyed the racing component. I've enjoyed the driving parts. You know, I like going through.
Well, that
the
was what I heard on the forum. So,
I don't know. I'm a part of the proletariat.
Well, McMaster, do you feel that? Let me ask you this: do you feel that the driving and the shooting are integrated well?
What, driving and shooting, or like you mean the first person shooter parts and the driving parts together?
As far as being part of a game as a whole, do you think they fit well together? Do you like here? You know, it's a loaded question. I'll just present it as a statement. I feel that the driving and the shooting are like two completely separate games that don't relate well to each other. When I am driving from point A to point B, I'm sort of wondering, why do I have to do this? What is this adding to the game, to the design? What is this bringing to the experience? And the answer invariably tends to be, well, not very much. It's busy work, it feels like. I can point to any, you can pick up pretty much any driving game, and I think you will get better driving than what you're getting in Rage.
As a driving game, sure. I don't know. I don't know. The game kind of reminds me of like MotorStorm in a lot of ways, the way it feels.
Well, but see, that's an important thing, because MotorStorm, for all its failings, had a great driving physics, and it felt, you know, the different vehicles really felt interactive with the environments. The environments branched. There were all these different paths you could go on.
Sure.
MotorStorm looked a lot like Rage, and so that's why when I'm playing Rage, when I'm just driving this one simple, there's only one path from point A to point B, and it's lit up on the GPS, and when I'm driving that, I'm reminded of MotorStorm, and in that comparison, I think Rage just suffers mightily. It's nowhere near as good as MotorStorm. And so I'm like, if you guys can't get to that level, if you're going to remind me of another game and then be about 10% as good as that game, you know, maybe you should rethink whether this is part of the game.
So you don't like the way it looks either? I mean, I really do like it. I mean, I like the design. I don't know.
At second hand, it does seem like it's attractively put together.
The opening
sequence, I watched all that in HD, and I thought,
I will say this, that opening sequence, though, that was like, I was like, oh boy, where'd they get this premise?
Yeah, the plot of the opening sequence has been roundly parodied. There's already a Penny Arcade comic about it that was rather witty.
Go ahead.
Well, McMaster, keep me posted after you've played through the sewers, after you've played through the power plant, you know, after...
I can tell you where I'm at. I mean, it's not like I'm not far into the game. It's not, but I'm not on the second disc. I'm on the first disc still. I mean, I just like, you know, the big mutant guy in the city or whatever that you have to go to.
Yep.
Yeah, I just got back from that mission.
So have you played that level the first time, or have you played it the second time where you have to go through it in the other direction?
No, I have not done that yet.
this is an example of how it is making use of their assets. You saw this level once? Hey, why not see it a second time going in the opposite direction?
Well, isn't like a lot of that, though, aren't those like optional side quest things?
No, you must mandatorily go through Dead City from point A to point B, and then later in the game, for no good reason, from point B to point A.
No, have fun with that. Was just saying that, I was just thinking that a lot of the, you know, like go through the hideouts are side quests.
There are some of those. Did you play Hellgate London, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you'll enjoy a little deja vu on disc two. I'll just leave that with you.
I mean, I guess I like... it's a little ludicrous, and I know some of the things are, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, et cetera, but I don't know. I'm really enjoying the game so far. I just like the way it feels. It controls well. And I really like, oddly enough, I like the building stuff and the lock grinder thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I like finding hidden stuff. And the card game is awesome. So, there.
Hey, I have heard excellent things about the mini games as well.
Yeah.
The card game is good if, other than the fact that, they could have gotten so much more out of it. I think they had this great opportunity for a collectible system / mini game, and they blew it because it doesn't know how to design a game to save their lives. The other mini games, including the die rolling game, which does nothing, you just roll dice, the guitar strumming game, and oh boy, wait till you get to that, McMaster, that's a lot of fun. What's the other mini game?
Mumbly Peg.
Oh my God, I seriously, so I couldn't, I don't know if it's just me, every single frickin' time, I never once didn't hit my finger in that. And I've played a whole lot of Five Finger Filet on Red Dead Redemption, so I don't know what's going on with that Mumbledypeg game. So McMaster, McMaster, help me out here. You love the game. Defend this. What's going on with that five finger fillet thing with the Mumble D-Peg? Why can't I not hit my finger? What am I supposed to do?
I have no earthly idea. I can't tell you. I always hit my finger too. I just kind of gave up on that one. Now, the dice rolling one is a little ridiculous because the odds are so completely stacked against you, like 90% of the time in that one, that you just end up, it's frustrating. But I really like the card game.
I would like to see the card game in a better game. I would like to see it better explained. I would like the mechanics to be a little clearer. And I would like to be able to look at my freaking cards when I'm not playing the game. So that
now,
when I find a
I'll
new
give
card,
you that one. I would like to be able to do that too. Yeah.
And so why doesn't id, like id fumbles little things like this so consistently that I have to wonder what the heck is going on over there. This sounds like hyperbole, but I just want to say those guys don't know what they're doing. You know, you've got this cool card game and you don't know how to leverage it and make people interested in it while you're playing. And I just, it's so irritating.
Go ahead, Jason.
Sorry, it seemed like, you know, there were probably broader, you know, design issues, and that the favorable response seems to be this is a very attractive console game with a shooter or a driving game / shooter that,
right,
you know, X person enjoyed. So usually the storyline or the design choices, and certainly the integration of mini games, were kind of like, oh, well, that was terrible, but I liked it. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is like, id games are all just all adrenaline. There's not a lot of, you know, thinking put into them. I mean, this is kind of like a thinking man's, you know, id game, comparable to what, like Doom, all the others. I don't know. I just the way it feels, the speed of it. And I like the racing part. Like, I enjoy, like, doing the races, you know? I like that part. I liked, you know, but I will agree with you on the arena thing, because I did die in, like, the fourth round or something like that one time, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. But I have to restart the Mutant Bash thing. Oh, God.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's nothing like that later in the game. That's the only time that happens. I was expecting there were going to be more of those little passages you had to get through where you couldn't save the game.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. McMaster, have you played, or JT, have either of you played Metro 2033?
Yeah.
So, if McMaster, can you name one thing that Rage does better or as well as Metro 2033?
Frame rate. No, it's you know, it's kind of like a different thing, though. I mean, Metro 23, for God's sakes, your bullets are money in Christ, you know.
Well, and you know what? You say it's a different thing, McMaster, and you're exactly right, but that is a sense of economy. Metro 23 has an economy that integrates money with shooting, the core gameplay value. Rage does no such thing. The economy in Rage is strictly a matter. We talked about urban exploration on last week's podcast.
Yeah.
The economy in Rage is based on a misguided representation of urban exploration. For them, urban exploration is the equivalent of running around with a big old bag and scooping stuff off of tabletops into the bag. Because anytime you get treasure, quote unquote, it's a big fat glowing thing on a tabletop. There is none of this sense of exploration, which is, and this is how it works in like Fallout and Dead Island, where you're poking around inside containers and you're actually looking in things and you're feeling interactive with the environment. Here, you're clicking on stuff that glows brightly to pick it up. And it's a minor issue, but I think it has a lot to do with how it feels like the place you're in. In Dead Island and in Fallout 3, it feels like you're in a dead place and you're rummaging around. Here, it feels like you're in a place where the game designers have put glowing bits for you to pick up that you will then translate into the economy. You're just scooping money off of tabletops. And Metro 23, you know, you have to make the decision between bullets and money. You know, do I fire my money for more effect, or do I save it to upgrade a gun? I'm sorry, you're getting me on a rant there, but that's one of the things that I feel Metro 23 does much better, this sense of an economy that's integrated with the core gameplay.
Well, I mean, the way I feel about Rage mostly is, it feels like, to me, Borderlands with better controls.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you're lacking the RPG, like the further RPG aspect. But I mean, it absolutely has, you know, Borderlands is full of that loot mania. You know, it's like that's the whole deal with Borderlands. It's like everything's glowing. Everything's, you know, you open a mailbox and like $5 flies out of it.
But Borderlands, though, to its credit, it's all focused on guns. Like the entire economy in Borderlands is based on what kind of gun are you going to be carrying around and shooting. And I feel there's a focus in Borderlands that is missing in Rage. And they're trying to do this BioShock kind of, you know, sandbox combat with little constructible things that you make. And I feel they just don't get it as well. You know, Borderlands at least had everything's going to channel into what kind of gun you're shooting. Here, they just don't have that kind of focus. You know what? You mentioned the RPG elements. I don't know if you've seen this, McMaster. You can go through the entire game and not realize it's there. But there is a display page in Rage that shows your character with his health and his armor, you know, because you can raise your health stat by making some special potion or whatever. But they put an RPG kind of page in there, and then they completely ignore it. You know, you never it's so non-interactive. And even when you go to it, there's these numbers. You don't know what that means. You know, my health, is it 100? Is it 111? What's the difference? Who cares? Because I've never seen numbers. You know, the whole way that health works with that fast regenerating Call of Duty type health, why do they even present whether or not your health is 100 or 111?
Well, I have Rage right here. Let's take a look. Are you talking about the one page, the statistics page, like with all that jazz?
Yeah, it's where you eventually like have to actually fairly early on, you pick one of three kind of like classes based on what kind
of right.
And so it's the page where you look at what kind of armor you're wearing, and it'll show, like, your health and your armor level and stuff. Anyway, you're just going to look at it because it's there, but you never needed to look at it. Like, you never interact with that page. It's like they have an RPG system, and they don't know what to do with it. They just dump it in there. There's so many things in Rage where I was thinking, you know, if I was, like, a producer here, I was like, you know what, we should cut this or make better use of it.
Yeah, so what did you think about, like, the character class choice? It was kind of weird. I didn't really expect it, and I actually kind of agonized over it for a minute, and I think I ended up picking the engineer guy just because I figured he would make the most, you know,
mm-hmm.
sense.
Yeah, I picked the same thing, and it never made one whit of difference to me
nice.
Later in the game. Like, I love the idea of, hey, Here's a difficult decision to make. Now make it, and when there's no fallout from that decision, I feel like I've been bamboozled.
Oh, you know, this is crazy. Actually, I'm just now looking at it, and I since I purchased the I pre-order most things from Amazon, and since they do release date delivery, I pre-ordered it. With a bunch of credit I had, I got a code with that for, you know, the Anarchy Edition. I have Crimson Elite armor, which is just awesome, apparently. It's the best of all worlds. It's all the characteristics of all the suits.
Ah, so if you pre-order, then the decision is even more meaningless.
Yes, it's completely meaningless. So, wow. Nice.
Great going. That's game design, Id. Well done. McMaster, did you get that awesome double-barrel shotgun?
Yeah, that thing's useless, actually.
Once again, that's great game design. Let's throw a bunch of empty or a bunch of useless weapons into your arsenal. I love it.
Yeah, what? See, the Crimson. The double barrel shotgun. Jeez. Yeah. You know, but to be fair, I don't like double barrel shotguns in almost any game. Just because they limit you. I mean, there's a ton of power there, but I would rather be able to fire 7 or 8 times.
You say they limit you, McMaster, and there is no reason that in good game design, a double-barrel shotgun should not be extremely useful. If it's not useful, don't put it in your freaking game.
I'm sure it has its use because
what is its use?
Up close, it has to be a ton of damage, but I didn't find out because I don't like double-barrel shotguns.
Because you've got the regular shotgun that shoots one. You can shoot, I think, what is it, 8? It holds 8 rounds. It's a regular shotgun. It's better to shoot 8 rounds consecutively than 2 rounds at once and then a 30-second reload time. That's what you get with the double-barrel shotgun.
Yeah, that's kind of its downside.
But you know what? It's kind of a moot point because it's not part of the core game. It's part of this, like, pre-order Like, if you buy it new, you get this. It's a retail edition and not a game design edition. So I probably shouldn't ding them for
retail
that.
Retail exclusives in general are pretty much hated by all right-thinking people everywhere. So
you know what, JT? If you buy this, you can get an exclusive sewer mission.
I did. I got that as well, actually. That's for the download, right? Yeah. Or not the download, but for the Legends
Anarchy.
Of the Wasteland.
Yeah, but it's a sewer mission. Doesn't that get you excited?
I actually thought you were being satirical after Jason McMaster's "I'm done with sewers" post a couple of days ago.
Nope. No, they actually call it. Yeah, it's the sewer mission. That's what it's called. That's exciting. That's it selling their content for you. You know what, JT? I hope you're happy. You've now driven a wedge between me and Jason R. McMaster.
Well, it's to essentially slam on the podcast. It's just chisel out McMaster on the nameplate. And
with a game you haven't even played. How dare you, JT?
Yeah, it was well played.
All right, so that's your news of the week. McMaster, did we do your – what was your news of the week?
Yeah, mine was jobs, yeah.
Oh, right, of course. How could I forget that? I'm a terrible person.
Yes.
Well, continuing the theme of driving wedges between me and Jason R. McMaster, my news of the week is this DLC for Gears of War 3, which is coming out November 1st. You only have to pay $10. And it's not even $10, really. It's just 800 Microsoft Space Bucks. So for all intents and purposes, it's free. Because what else are you going to spend those points on? It gives you some skins. It gives you 3 maps. That's kind of the usual stuff you expect from DLC. But it also gives you additional stuff that you can level up in Horde mode. Now, the way Horde mode works, it's an awesome new mode, and I do love it, and I say this with no irony or facetiousness. You're playing Horde mode, but you're building defenses. And as you build defenses, you get sort of experience points in a pool towards that type of defense. And you get more and more powerful defenses, and you unlock new defenses, and it's kind of an RPG meta game. So what the DLC adds is new levels. You can level up your stuff even higher. And you can get new equipment on your silverback mech. You can even earn a whole new thing called a command center that somehow lets you, like, call in. Sounds like artillery strikes or Hammers of Dawn stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
It is awesome, and I want that. And why isn't it in the core game, Jason R. McMaster? Tell me now.
Because they got to make a buck.
It's basically free anyway. It's only 800 space bucks.
Yeah, exactly.
800 space bucks, JT. 800 space bucks. But yeah, you're right. It is free. So anyway, I just DLC. It's this stuff is so out of control. And I
agree with you. I mean, it's a little ridiculous. It got to the point. I mean, but that just happened where they just stopped including the entire game in the game.
Right.
You know. And then DLC is like, well, for instance, like I think a great example of that was the Dragon Age stuff. Now, I mean, completely blame them. I don't, you know, I mean, if
is
you
Dragon
bought the
Age
game,
2 you're thinking?
Either one.
Okay.
If you bought the game new, you got everything. But if you didn't, you got, if you bought it used or whatever, you were missing a character. And most of the time, or like in Dragon Age specifically,
it was actually worse than that.
It was a really cool character. What was it in 2?
In Dragon Age 2, if you pre-ordered, you got a fairly integral, I guess, party member who was a prince from Orlais or something like that. If you didn't pre-order, it was DLC. And I'm basically... I don't like the concept of DLC, so I didn't buy it. So essentially, I was missing a character that everybody who had pre-ordered and a lot of other people who bought DLC all had this character.
There was also an issue with storage space in that game. Like, you had to buy storage space as DLC.
Well, that was a little ridiculous, yeah.
I think that was Dragon Age the first one. It was the Warden's
yes,
Fortress.
Yes, it was the first one, correct.
Yeah,
yes.
They were more sensible about that in the sequel, so...
JT, what level are you in Gears of War 3's Horde mode?
I am a non-playing observer of Gears of War 3's Horde mode. I do like the concept of introducing a sort of quasi-strategic metagame to games of that nature.
Yeah.
And the
it's
idea
good.
Of focusing on that for expansions of the game, I think is probably a positive thing.
Yep.
Yeah, I do too, actually. Though, I mean, yeah. I mean, I bought the freaking content pack because, you know, I can't help myself. And I was going to buy it anyway. You know, the season pass thing or whatever.
Yep. Well, they've got me. I'll be I don't know if I'll get a press copy or not, but if not, I will definitely be forking over the space bucks for whatever that command center is. I want it. I want that thing.
Yeah, I do too. You know, you and I will be blowing the hell out of some freaking locusts pretty soon for that command center.
Yeah, I don't know. Jason R. McMaster, I don't know if we should let JT join us if he doesn't even have his silverbacks unlocked.
Freaking noob.
All right, so that's my news of the week. You can pay $10 on November 1st to get the rest of Gears of War 3. Let's go on to games of the week.
Oh.
Jason R. McMaster, what is your... I'm going to make a prediction that you and I have the same game of the week.
Well, I was... I guess I can be going with Dark Souls.
Why didn't you pick Rage, Jason R. McMaster?
We discussed Rage at great length 5 minutes ago. Okay.
But what you're saying then is that Rage is not good enough to be your game of the week?
Oh, it is. It is. Actually, it was going to be my game of the week, but I think, well...
My wedge has been well driven.
No, I mean, honestly, it could still be my game of the week. I'm just happy to talk about Dark Souls, and I'm sure that's probably what you want to discuss.
Now, JT, do you know this Dark Souls game?
I am familiar with it from reviews, and I'm also familiar with Demon Souls and the sort of the general concept of the game, and it's sort of revisiting the idea of the punishingly hard game a la Ninja Gaiden or Battletoads.
But you have not played either of them, is that correct?
Well, I did beat Ninja Gaiden, but I never beat Battletoads, so I figured that was where I should stop.
Man, Battletoads was hard.
Battletoads was pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, it really was.
Now, Jason R. McMaster, do you feel that's a fair comparison? Like those old school games like Ninja Gaiden and Battletoads that JT mentioned, and let's talk Dark Souls specifically, is that game difficult in the same way or not?
Yes and no. I mean, yes to an extent because it requires, you know, memorization. It requires reflexes. And it is impossibly hard and just, like, cruelly unforgiving. But I think at the same time, those games were designed to eat quarters, you know, initially. Or just to, like, well, at least Ninja Gaiden was. Whereas Demon's Souls or Dark Souls are designed to, Dark Souls specifically, it's designed to, I don't know, it's almost like, I don't even know. You know, it's the, it's similar, but it's not. There's a certain amount of more, like, a certain higher level of control you have in Dark Souls than something like, Battletoads or Ninja Gaiden.
Well, I guess it's in a sense the extreme difficulty is by design, whereas as you pointed out,
sure.
With the 8-bit consoles, it was kind of more just a thoughtless carryover from arcade games to a certain extent.
Right. I mean, and it just comes down to Dark Souls is a game that calls you a sissy, and you must stand up to it.
It seems to me that the design mandate in Dark Souls and Demon Souls as well, and it's something that so few games are willing to do, is to put the player through these crushing lows and ecstatic highs.
Oh, yes.
And you cannot have one without the other. One of our the folks from the forum, a fellow named Andrew Mayer, once famously said to me, because I think it explains video gaming so well, that video gaming is the art of enjoyable frustration, and you need both aspects of that to a certain degree. You know, you've got to have fun, you've also got to have a challenge. And Demon's Souls is kind of pushing that paradigm to its limit. You know, the limits of frustration therefore make, when you actually get through something, make it that much more quote-unquote fun or enjoyable. You get that much more of a high from beating a challenge after you've, like, lost it 20 times or whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
And that, to me, is what Dark Souls does so well. Although I want to say I'm not sure that that's necessarily something that people look for in their video games. There's a very good friend of mine, and I know other people feel this way, has said that everybody should play he was speaking specifically about Demon's Souls. And he was trying to talk my other friends into, you know, get this Demon's Souls thing. It's great. You should play it. I could not disagree more.
No, it's not for everybody.
It is not for everybody, and I hate this idea that some people have that this game is so good that all people should play it. I disagree so strongly with that. It's only for a specific type of gamer. It meets a very specific type of need, and I don't recommend it. I would say actually to many people at all. I mean, I love it, but I wouldn't recommend it freely.
I think that there's a tendency with difficult acquired tastes and aficionados of a particular, you know, subculture, however laudable it actually is, to think that, oh, well, this is the best example of this,
right.
So it will appeal, it will have mass appeal. This is the best, most accessible album by some really difficult indie artist. So this will be the one that the top 40 people really enjoy.
Right, right. So. And not only, and the thing is, even going a little bit beyond what you're saying, JT, even as far as the genre, if you look at the genre of RPGs, it's not, even if you love RPGs, I don't necessarily think you would like Dark Souls. Like, people who love World of Warcraft, if you like World of Warcraft, that has nothing to do with whether or not you're going to like Dark Souls.
Basically, take World of Warcraft and go as far away from it as humanly possible in the game design spectrum.
Which is a little odd, because, yeah, and they're both RPGs, though. I mean, I freely grant that they're in the same genre, but they take different approach.
One could argue that I think CRPGs and MMORPGs, there's a fairly strong genre divide, I feel.
Sure, sure. Well, and that almost gets to what McMaster was saying about how some games are designed to eat quarters. Some games are designed to get you to pay a monthly subscription fee with the least amount of challenge, and that's the case of with World of Warcraft, whereas Demon's Souls doesn't have to worry about that. If you've spent your $60 and you get 15 minutes into the game and you can't get any farther, Demon's Souls doesn't care.
Demon's Souls has won.
Yes.
Another comparison might be the 2008 Prince of Persia reboot, which was the really easy one.
Yep.
And in that case, the people are saying, all right, well, we have your $60, so we'll give you 6 hours of spectacle.
Right. Very good. Very good, JT.
The one thing about Dark Souls and Demon's Souls before it is that these aren't really new games. From Software is a pretty old company, and they've made a bunch of games called Kingsfield. And Kingsfield's very similar.
What platform can I play Kingsfield's on, Jason McMaster?
PSX, I believe. God, is there one on the PS2? I don't know. They're much older, but they're From Software games, and it's kind of in the same. Exact same vein, you know, you're kind of dropped off mysteriously and you're wandering through this like extremely hostile, forbidding world with no real help. You know, it feels the exact same. Sarah was really obsessed with one of the Kingsfields that we found, and she played it on the PS3 because we have like one of the cool dude PS3s, the launch ones that actually play old games. Mm-hmm. And, so she played through that, after Demon's Souls, because good lord, Demon's Souls wasn't enough for her. And now she's, of course, destroying Dark Souls.
Plays pinball as well, doesn't she? I'm just wondering if there might be a carryover between pinball players and, you know, punishingly hard game players.
Did I tell you, Tom, that she beat like 160 million on Miss Splosion Man?
No, she did not. She has 141 million, and I know this for sure because what I did last night was I sat down to beat your wife's frickin' super score. Shut up. It's not funny.
It's hilarious. No, it's not just regular funny.
It is actually pretty funny.
It's super funny.
Okay. Well, I just want to say who's laughing now because I finally did it. So there. and it sure wasn't on her Miss Explosion Man high score, because I cannot imagine how she freaking got 141 million on that annoying pink loud stupid table. Good lord, I hate that.
Yeah, it is honest to God one of the worst like sounding tables or any worst sounding anythings I've ever heard. And it's like, I think Sarah put it best with the best thing that Miss Splosion Man did, the table, was to absolutely ensure that she would never play Miss Splosion Man the game if it sounds anything like that. So
Well, I do. I was going to gloat, McMaster, but I can't because your super score is so freaking high. I don't expect I'll be getting near that anytime. So, but I did beat your wife's super score, so I have beat half of the McMaster household when it comes to Pinball FX. But I want to get to JT's point, which I don't know if you were serious, JT, but if you weren't, you accidentally made a fantastic point that I kind of wanted to make, and that is when I play Demon's Souls or Dark Souls, a lot of times I will play and I will make no progress whatsoever. I'm trying to reach a certain point. I'm trying to open a certain door. I'm trying to beat a certain boss, and I keep screwing up before I even reach the boss and dying. But I can sit down with Dark Souls, and I can play for an hour, and I can have absolutely nothing to show for it in terms of advancement. Now, someone in the comments section, because I sort of complained about this in a post that I wrote, and someone in the comments section very wisely pointed out it's not an RPG that you play to necessarily increase your stats or get new loot every time. You are learning the system. You are getting better at the combat. You are learning the environment. It's something that you do. There is repetition involved, and you get better as you're playing. Now, that kind of helps explain a little bit of what they're going for, but it also, you know, there are other RPGs I can play that just give me free stuff anyway, that when I play for an hour, I get experience points no matter what. It's a difficult paradigm to adjust to. However, I just want to point out, though, real quick, JT, when you mentioned Pinball FX, it's the same thing. When I sat down to play Pinball FX last night to beat Sarah's, Jason's wife's high score, I played for a while and I didn't get the score, and so I got nothing for my time. What I did get, I got no tangible, reward. I got no number went up. I didn't get a better high score. I didn't earn XP. I didn't unlock anything. However, what I did get was more familiar with the table. I learned the table. I learned some of the modes. I learned how to do the jackpots or whatever. And so I don't know if you were serious, JT, but that is actually, I think, a very canny insight into both game designs.
I was serious, and actually, in a bizarre coincidence, one of the games that I was thinking about was Misplosion Man the Game and other games of that nature, which are to say they have a somewhat punishing trial and error aesthetic.
Oh, right, yeah.
Or ethic, I guess. And, it seems to me that there might be a certain carryover there, and that they're training you to be better at the game rather than giving you a tangible reward as you play.
And I love too to see a game that doesn't resort to this sort of model of let's add an RPG thing where you go up a few levels even if you suck. Let's give the player some little reward. Let's treat him like a rat in a lab and give him a piece of food no matter what to keep him playing. I kind of respect a game that is willing to not use that model.
The big thing for me was I recently reviewed it for Game Shark, and in the review I compare it to golf as I play golf, and
which I love that analogy.
Valid analogy, actually.
It felt a little tortured to me because I don't know the first. Well, I know a little about golf. I didn't quite get that, but go ahead and explain the analogy to us, McMaster.
When you play golf, and I'm still in this phase because I've only played a few years, but you don't hit anything consistently. You mess around. You get better, but you get better slowly, and it's really frustrating. And some days you have just a really good round, and some days you have an awful round that just makes you want to quit, and you just, hell, I've come close to throwing away my clubs, It's just, it can be a very frustrating game, but on the alternate end of that is just how exhilarating it is when you do hit a good shot, when you do something good in the game. It's a very, it's very exhilarating. It's I don't know.
You get the sense too that you're progressing along a skill curve, essentially, where once you're a middle-aged or older golfer with a little bit of golf skill, you're now competent at something which someone starting out is incredibly terrible at. So it's a learned proficiency with a very large learning curve.
Well, as a middle-aged Dark Souls player, I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah, it's just the same thing with Dark Souls, and Demon Souls before it. as you mentioned, I think on the site, Tom, that running across that bridge with the dragon, oh. You know, there are so many leaps of faith in those games. they're really ridiculous. In fact, that part is incredibly reminiscent of a couple of parts in Demon's Souls, where you had to outrace a dragon breathing down a bridge, and then you'd duck into an alcove and it'd go past, then you'd have to start running again, you know, et cetera. And, there's actually quite a few places in Dark Souls where I've gone, yeah, that's kind of the same guy. Should I say spoiler alerts? Oh my goodness, spoiler alerts. The guy, you know, when you first start the game, you know, Mr. Glib Asshole NPC, which, I mean, really, honestly, all the NPCs in that game are totally glib assholes. I totally don't even understand how you could want to like any of those characters, but I think that's partially the point. Right. He's like, you know, you need to ring a bell at the top, and you need to ring a bell at the bottom. And so you go up, of course, because everywhere else you just you spend your entire time getting a foot out of your ass. But you go up, you slowly fight through, you get through this cathedral, and then you get up to the roof of it, and you walk out, and there's a gargoyle. And the gargoyle's got a weak tail, and then halfway through the fight, another gargoyle shows up. All right, that is directly from Demon's Souls. I mean, that fight, basically. There's a fight in Demon's Souls, except it's not just based on his health, but it's a gargoyle you have to fight. He's up on this roof. After a certain amount of time, another one shows up. You have to kill both of them. The end. There's just a few parts like that that I've noticed that are just kind of weird to me, that they just completely repeated. But, yeah, that game.
I wonder if part of what's going on there is they know there's going to be a new audience. This isn't just a PS3 exclusive anymore. It's on the 360.
Right. They hit the big leagues.
And they also have a new – I think the main new thing is the way that they are laying out the world. Rather than five separate worlds with five separate doors, it's a large contiguous world. And I like that sense, so I don't mind if they want to carry over some of the same tricks, because they're putting the tricks kind of in a new bag, if you will.
Now, I will say that, I kind of like the way it runs together, and it feels really good the way that works. But I kind of don't – I don't know. I kind of miss Demon's Souls, because each portal represented this huge design change and area change, you know? I mean, whereas in – and admittedly, I'm not through Dark Souls. I'm going to be playing the game for freaking ever. I haven't seen that huge drastic difference in the areas. Now, I mean, sure, there's, you know, the swampy whatever, and there's the river area and all that, but, you know, Demon's Souls, you had the mages area, the prison, and all those different areas. There's really cool different, design feels.
I suspect that will happen eventually. It will just be more gradual. It won't be. And I like that about the world design, is that it's not a matter of you go through this door, you're in this kind of world. You go through that door, you're in that kind of world. As someone who just got past those freaking bell gargoyles, and so now things are opening up, and I am kind of in a new environment. I liked kind of how long it took to earn that new environment. I like kind of how gradual the transition was from the castle to the forest. I have to say I don't miss that, McMaster. I like how the world does feel like it pieces together better. That's working for me.
I don't know what it was. There was something striking about the environs in Demon's Souls comparably to me. I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe it's just the first time in Demon's Souls you walk out and you're in that castle, and it's actually kind of a well laid out level. It's not just like some kind of crazy thing. It actually kind of makes sense. And everything's so realistic and harsh. There's just something about the actual look of Demon's Souls, I guess, as compared. But
my theory is that you're just sick of the undead Berg.
Oh, no, and I, yeah. The undead Berg is a son of a... I did go down into, that crystal forest area a little bit, though, or, where those crystal dudes are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those guys suck.
JT, what level are you in Dark Souls?
I am, unfortunately, just an interested observer of both Dark Souls.
Okay, well, we call that level zero.
Yes, zero.
okay, so this might be the first time that's happened, Jason R. McMaster, where we've both had the same game of the week. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think, well, yeah, because I didn't pick Dead Island that week, I think. Or did, no, I picked it the week after you did.
Now, here is an interesting conundrum, if you will, and I think I know where you would fall on this, Jason R. McMaster. JT, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You've got a niche game. Pretend, JT, that you are a game reviewer. You have a niche game like Dark Souls that you love, but you know it's not for everyone. You love it so much. It's one of your favorites, personally. But you know that the average person might pick it up and be alienated. Maybe not everyone should play it. Does a game like that deserve a high grade on a review?
Well, I mean, deserves is kind of taking an unnecessarily philosophical approach to it.
Don't you get academic with me, young man. like, do you give it a high score, I guess, is where I'm going.
From a pragmatic point of view, you give it a high score. Because that way other people will be suckered into playing it. Some of them will like it. The community will be that much larger and more people will be able to appreciate how high a level you are.
Well, aren't you mercenary? Yeah, okay. But so you're reviewing it. Let's say you've got the Jason Townsend gamer page and you're doing your review on a game like Dark Souls that you love but that not everyone would like. What score does it get? A high score or a middling score?
I think I would probably, you know, give it a high score because I felt that it was excellent. But I would ladle on the caveats very explicitly, which, you know, one does usually see with niche games of this nature.
But the caveats would not affect the score?
Well, I think the caveats probably, you know, cover you from the point of view of, you know, not misleading your reader. Mm-hmm. And that really is the only thing you have to discharge in terms of an ethical responsibility. If somebody is just going on the basis of the fact that you pushed the Metacritic up by a fraction of a decimal point, then it's their fault for having a dumb way of picking games.
Jason R. McMaster, do you agree with that? You love – actually, I kind of know the answer because I know what you gave Dark Souls.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, I believe that it's the same way that, like, if you were to watch, say, for instance – a movie that might not be for everyone, but it's an excellent movie. Would you rate it highly? You know, I mean, if you would, I mean, you would want to, I would hope, you know, you would, the idea that it's a rating of the excellence of the product. Now that's the way it is. Now, of course, every website has a different feeling on that, but nobody takes that into account anymore because there's Metacritic. So it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I would instead – the way that I would put it is the score only reflects how much I like it. Mm-hmm. That's all that I'm looking for in a score. And I agree with you, JT. Part of talking about the experience of a game like Dark Souls is you do mention those caveats.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But I hate this idea, and it sounds like neither of you is pushing this, that a score should reflect – whether or not you recommend it. I think that's a common perception in the way that a lot of people do and look at game reviews is the score is a recommendation, and I disagree. The score is strictly a reflection of how much the writer likes the game.
I don't think there's really a shortage of a place to look for recommendations, and that sort of that service, if you will, is already being provided by Metacritic, by large game sites, and it's not necessary to serve that need in every review.
And, well, I mean, frankly, the most hilarious part of all of this is that the people that get upset about reviews and the people that discuss reviews the most are the people who have already purchased the product. I mean, if you know what I'm saying. It's like they're not – you don't see a lot of comments about like, oh, hey, you saved me from purchasing something. You see a lot of comments about, hey, you're stupid. Because you don't like what I like.
Right. It's this idea of championing your own
culture. Right. So honestly, there's a large section of the public that does just go to the aggregation sites. Right. And there's, or just, hey, it's big and it's got some guns in it. I saw it on Hulu or something in a commercial.
I actually would be fairly hard-pressed to figure out how I would review my game of the week for this week.
Ah, provocative lead-in. What would that be? Yeah, what is your what are your reservations here?
It sort of has to do with what we're talking about. It's Red Orchestra 2, Heroes of Stalingrad.
I'm curious about that.
Yeah, and it's the difficulty is that it wasn't just a game that I felt was good, but that wouldn't appeal to everybody. It's a game that was kind of released in an objectively poor state, lacking some of the things that a game like it ought to have had. That if you recommended it to people, it might not be that it just wasn't for them, but that, you know, arguably you were championing the good things about a game that wasn't entirely good.
Well, first, tell us what basically this Red Orchestra 2 thing is. It's like a music game, right? Like Rock Band?
It's essentially a World War II musical.
a lot of John Philip Sousa, I presume.
Red Orchestra was a mod that was eventually turned into a full game, I believe. I didn't actually play the original Red Orchestra, although I knew about it and I kind of wanted to play it. Red Orchestra 2 was intended to be a bigger, splashier, wider release. It had some good press before it released, some good stuff on Rock, Paper, Scissors and different forums. It's a shooter set in Stalingrad, so it's Germans against Soviet Union, and it's very realism-oriented, not quite to the degree of, for example, Arma 2, mm-hmm. but probably more of a realism-oriented shooter than...
Like Counter-Strike.
I would say, I mean, a lot of people played Day of Defeat, which was a source World War II game.
Yeah.
This is a little bit further along the line towards Arma 2, so Day of Defeat, I think, had prone position and you know, toggled crouching and that sort of thing, but it's all to a greater extent in Red Orchestra. So even on the not-so-hardcore mode, for example, you need to use iron sights if you want to shoot a rifle at all. I mean, shooting from the hip is almost never going to work unless you're at point-blank range with a submachine gun or something. So it tends to be very demanding of the gamer. The problem
Say that you were elite. Would that make a difference in how you could shoot?
You could be very elite at Call of Duty Black Ops or even Battlefield Bad Company 2 and show up and be pretty useless. And part of that isn't just the fact that it's you know, designed in a particular way. Part of that is that there is no manual. It was released a PDF, a text file, or a FAQ. So I actually had to figure out what the game modes were essentially just by playing. Like, how do you capture a control point? Well, there's dotted lines on the map, and you have to be inside the dotted line, or you're basically not contributing towards the team effort, except in rare circumstances. And you have to find that out by somebody yelling it at you in chat, because it isn't really indicated anywhere. There's a single-player campaign, which acts as a little bit of a tutorial and introduces a lot of game concepts, but it's kind of playing multiplayer levels against bots.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, when you start to play something like that, you think to yourself, well, this is silly. I should just play the multiplayer. And that is actually how I learned the game. But either way, it's not explained. There's also differing game modes, and some of them are played a lot less than others, and it's difficult when you go to that. Sometimes it'll switch to the less played game mode, and the entire server will depopulate. Another thing was that at launch, the statistics of the game, like it tracks a whole variety of statistics, your accuracy with weapons, a leveling up system, all the things that we've come to expect in multiplayer first-person shooters. But it was, for some reason, completely haywire, so it would give you, you know, thousands of kills with a weapon that you'd never used in your life, or you would play for hours on end and it wouldn't do anything at all. And that wasn't actually fixed from release until about now. I think it's working now, and there's going to be a stat reset sometime very soon. So I think that may have gone a certain distance to alienate a lot of the audience, and the population in the game has decreased pretty strikingly since the release. I posted a chart on the thread on the forum, which shows the Steam usage over time, and it's a fairly sharp decline.
Now, JT, you mentioned the stats being screwed up. I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch. Did you say that there was any sort of in-game effect? Are there unlockables or anything that this affects? Or this is just for, like, bragging rights?
There are unlockables. Most of them are not enormously important. Like there's a drum magazine for a submachine gun and things like that. Most of them are not crucial, but the fact that they're there, because they are there, one tends to want them to work correctly.
And so that system was borked. Like people were either unlocking or not unlocking stuff correctly because their stat tracking was screwed up.
Yes, it was pretty obviously broken.
Right.
The flip side of all of this was that that and, of course, the usual hardware problems that people had, and also the fact that the graphics, while they were very serviceable, were not all that astonishing for the demandingness of the ultra detail settings. But the flip side of all of that was that the game itself is actually excellent. It has an excellent ambiance. The immersion is great. You guys were talking on the last podcast about, for example, Far Cry 2, where you have you can see the visuals of getting in and out of cars and things like that. That's handled quite well in Red Orchestra 2, so you'll be sneaking through a building and there'll be dust falling from the ceiling and you'll hear mysterious hollow wooden footsteps and a little snatch of Russian or German. And the players sort of do this spontaneous chatter, a bit like Company of Heroes. And it's all very immersive and can contribute to some really white-knuckle situations.
Now, you mentioned hardware problems, but this is a Source Engine game, isn't it?
I believe so. I think the hardware problems were more of a frame rate type of thing.
I see, right.
Graphics optimization.
Like it's biting off a little more than it can chew with the Source Engine?
Yeah, essentially the complaint on the forums, and you always have to take that with a bit of a grain of salt, this is the Tripwire forums, was that a game that looks like this should not be giving me X FPS. And this is from the people with three video cards and water cooling.
Now, Red Orchestra, it's not just infantry-based, am I correct? Like, there's a strong vehicle component in this?
There is a vehicle component. Strong is perhaps questionable. It's an attractive vehicle component in that you have different positions inside the tank. You can have a commander, a driver, and a loader. And if one of the crew members is hit, you can swap out and your character kind of clambers over to the other position inside of the tank. Again, a bit like Far Cry 2. Uh-huh. So it's gorgeous to look at. It's wonderful to play when everything is working correctly. But very often, these technical problems interposed, especially in the weeks after launch. But also because the game modes were sort of very hardcore and unexplained, you would sometimes just be on a team full of hapless people who were new to the game from a simpler shooter. And it would be, a one-sided massacre. And, you know, playing a one-sided massacre for 40 minutes or an hour can be pretty frustrating and a strong contrast to the hour in which you're playing on a really great team and it's the most immersive shooter you've played in years.
Now, JT, one who jumps into the game, if I did have the patience and I stuck with the single-player campaign that you mentioned, by the time I got through with it, would I be equipped to jump into a multiplayer game, or do you feel that even after that there's still a lot that's left unexplained?
I think that it would probably have avoided some of the problems that I had. I simply skipped that and I did jump into the multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And I managed, but I mean, you know, I played Battlefield Bad Company 2 and I played some of the old World War II shooters that had class systems and things like that. So I wasn't a complete neophyte coming from a sort of console shooter expectation. Because nowadays the console shooters are very well designed in terms of informing all the players what the game is. This is the objective. This is how we're going to the objective. And even with a slick game like Team Fortress 2, you still sometimes have people who won't stand on the spot. Well, with Red Orchestra 2, even a well-intentioned, fairly smart player won't be standing on the spot because he doesn't realize that anybody who's outside one of the vital buildings on the map is actually a slacker, as it were.
I just that's so, to me, annoying that they would that Tripwire would go to all the effort of making this, and not pave the way better for new players. That is so incredibly crucial. especially in a multiplayer game, to cultivate a multiplayer community and keep them on board. That's so disappointing to hear, JT. You make me not want to – I mean, I know you're trying to say good things about the game, but you're making me just glad that I didn't even bother with it.
Well, essentially, this would be the scenario where I would give a high score to the game because I really love the things that it does best and the attention that went into things. There's a quite a good cover system. There's complaints about it because it doesn't give you that much of an advantage. But the cover system gives you a steadier aim for having the gun rested on something. But it also has an interesting collision mechanic where if you're not careful about what direction your rifle is when you go into cover, it'll stick up a little bit. And it actually does it in quite a plausible-looking manner. So if you're looking for enemy soldiers in enemy cover, you'll sometimes see, you know, a rifle that will swing up over the sill by accident, the same way as one imagines that it might do. And so it kind of gives you a visual cue. There's a lot of things that the game does right, but the question is, in the long run, whether or not there'll be a critical mass for
community right.
after having completely dropped the ball in the hand-holding aspect.
Well, I'll play if I can be the Americans.
I don't even know why they wouldn't add on Western Allies units. In a way, I mean, it would just be a matter of... Well, I suppose they would have to add a lot of new sound assets and everything else.
I'm sure it's DLC. DLC Americans. Jason R. McMaster, when we play, I'm gonna need you to be the reloader in the tank, okay?
All right. That sounds fair.
Just keep pressing E. Just E, E, E. Just make sure that I've always got a bullet ready. Because you actually... I have to say, McMaster... You play one hell of a reloader on that train level in Lost Planet 2.
Hey, I'm a pretty good reloader on the old Vulcan as well, the Vulcan minigun.
Ah, that's right. Yes, sure. In Horde mode. Yeah.
I have quite a bit of experience reloading.
So, JT, there's a gun in Gears of War 3 that is so big that one person shoots it and the other person has to walk around behind them, carry the ammo box, playing the reloading minigame.
If you think about it, from a standpoint of military logistics, they've obviously gone to all the trouble of, you know, creating these 500-pound Marines. It only makes sense to utilize them to carry around heavy ammunition. So,
well, you know, that kind of firepower has a long tail.
Yeah, it sure does.
All right, Red Orchestra 2, in which Jason R. McMaster will be volunteering to play the loader in everyone's tank.
Absolutely.
Actually, what is that like? Does someone really have to sit in a chair just like looking at the side of a tank interior, pressing E over and over?
I think the loader may have an alternative function. I actually haven't done the tank role in part because I usually want to make the most constructive impact on a game that I can, mm-hmm. and I tend not to, for example, play the sniper. There's, I think, only usually one sharpshooter, mm-hmm. and I'm not all that great at it, so I don't do that. There's usually only one machine gunner. I'm kind of okay at that, so I'll do that, but I often tend to pick a fairly unimportant job so that I won't be the one dragging the team down.
So teams are limited by the number of snipers. Like that's a limitation built in the gameplay.
Yes, and it's quite a fortuitous one because otherwise the system wouldn't really work. There's an anti-tank role in which the player can use a sort of anti-material rifle, mm-hmm. Which is sort of the main infantry anti-tank option. There's also some others, but that's the main one. There's a commander who can call in aerial reconnaissance and issue orders and also bring in a couple kinds of artillery. So, again, it does get into sort of the metagame, a little bit of strategy in the same sort of, well, to a lesser extent than Gears of War 3, perhaps, and if there's no construction involved.
So what you're saying, JT, is that Gears of War 3 is a more serious strategy game than Red Orchestra 2?
As soon as the words crossed my lips, I started to have serious reservations. But in a sense, there isn't a if you call in artillery, you can't call in artillery until the cooldown runs out. So, I mean, that, there's an element of strategy to that. But there isn't base construction. So.
Right. So, JT, can someone – now you mentioned that the player base is kind of dwindling. I presume that even with a dwindled player base, you can find a good server, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The servers can go up to 64 players,
Nice.
Which can sort of suck up an awful lot of players in a hurry when the player base is sort of in the low thousands. But there are at the moment still servers with reasonable pings.
You remind me of a game that I did not even know existed until I got the review assignment for, that just launched, I think, this week, that sounds very similar to Red Orchestra 2. It has more of a sci-fi bent, and their whole angle is that one player on each team plays the commander.
Yeah, I was thinking about that one, too.
Oh, so you know about this. So he's playing basically an RTS. He sits in a little booth at a screen, and from his perspective, it's a top-down map, and he's building power stations and respawn points and resupply points, and he's playing it like an turrets, and he's playing it like an RTS, whereas everyone else on his team, and he can give them orders, which they can then ignore, everybody else on his team is playing a shooter, and it's called Nuclear Dawn.
Yes.
Which is
terrible name.
Terrible, terrible name. And similar to Red Orchestra 2, JT, Nuclear Dawn has these, I think, like four, maybe five, like 2-3 minute videos that you can watch that explain the basic game concepts, but do a terrible job overall letting you know what's going on and what you're supposed to do. And there is nothing whatsoever in this game to prepare someone for sitting in that commander's point. And there are so few populated servers that I would not deign to jump onto one of those games and try to be the commander and subject all these other poor people playing to me not knowing what's going on. And for that, I blame the designers. They did not provide any sort of – you can't jump into a game with bots. You know, at least Red Orchestra 2 has that. But they've just done such a terrible job introducing players to their concepts.
I feel bad because, you know, in a sense, Nuclear Dawn was really the logical next step, if you look at Red Orchestra and Gears of War 3, in integrating this metagame into the game. And it's marvelous how much credit it's giving players for being able to organize it and create their own wonderful emergent gameplay. But in practice, you know, Red Orchestra 2 is known before it was even released that this is going to be a serious Rivet Counters FPS. Mm-hmm. And it's for serious people. But a lot of games, you'll join a server and there won't be any commander. Nobody bothered to pick one. They just wanted a submachine gun instead. And, you know, when there isn't any commander at all and the other side is dropping in artillery and aerial reconnaissance, you know, it sort of makes you wonder how much credit exactly is the right amount of credit to give the gaming community.
I've been in games of Nuclear Dawn where I jump into a game in progress, and basically I'm on the team where everybody is hemmed in at their base, and the other team is like expanded around the whole map, and they're you know, most of the hemmed in team has quit, has left, so there's like, you know, six of us holding out against like 20 people who've got the whole map, and nobody has done the surrender option yet because you can surrender. But yeah, it makes me wonder, is it worth sticking with games like this for those odd servers that you find and those situations that you find where there is a sense of balance and both teams are fully taking advantage of the gameplay mechanics? You know, when that comes together, it's awesome, but is it worth slogging through those games where either nobody's the commander in Red Orchestra 2 or the commander in Nuclear Dawn just has no idea what he's doing and the game is essentially over as soon as it starts?
Yeah. And also, is even if it were worth it for these, for example, for clan play, even if it is worth it, is it really commercially sensible to have, you know, a game that a month or two after release will have, you know, a very small player base?
Right. JT, what level are you in Red Orchestra 2?
Well, there's a level reset coming up, so I will shortly be level 0. I think I was randomly booted from level 17 up to level 40 or something by some statistical glitch. So,
Very good.
That, there was actually no sense of reward whatsoever in that.
Take advantage of that. Event. Jason R. McMaster, what level are you in Red Orchestra 2?
14. I mean, I guess. I don't know.
For all we know, that's right. There's probably some glitch, McMaster, that has promoted both you and I to level 14.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad someone picked a serious game for Game of the Week instead of this slacker Dark Souls stuff.
So, yeah. What's up with that crap?
All right, so those are our games of the week. Two votes for Dark Souls, one vote for Red Orchestra. I think we won that one, JT. We outnumbered you.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Everybody on this podcast hates Rage, except for one of us. Poor Steve Jobs. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, JT.
Strictly having not played Rage, I would probably abstain from that one.
Okay, so I'll say everyone hates it except for one person who doesn't care enough to play it.
Yeah, I left it in the middle of the room and then watched the ensuing maelstrom of recriminations.
and then one of us who says it's his game of the decade. We're all very pumped about Steve Jobs. You'd think I'd figure this out. Gears of War 3 DLC available November 1st. Get your space bucks ready. Post of the week, congratulations to Rucker and what was yours, JT? No, that was yours. What was yours, McMaster?
The To Michael thread.
Ah, yes, and to Brian Kasp's PlayStation commercial. By the way,
yes.
do we know, it looked a little long and weirdly paced for an American television commercial. Is it just some like viral video that Sony put out there, or are they actually buying airtime with that thing? Do we know?
I think it's like they're playing like a little bit of the beginning of it and probably doing like a watch the rest kind of thing or something. That's what I'd imagine.
Or just putting it on YouTube.
Yeah, Brian Kasp lives in the Czech now, huh?
Oh, Brian Kasp has lived in the Czech Republic for many years now. He got himself an awesome Czech wife. To whom he's married, as is the case with wives. And he learned the language, and he's one of those folks who went over there to be an actor, and we all kind of laughed at him. And a few years later, he appears in the Hellboy movie, and
yeah.
He's doing commercials, and he's making a living in Prague as an American actor, bless his heart. And I see him every now and then in some like crappy horror movie. Brian Kasp, one of the most famous Americans in Prague, as far as I'm concerned. So, all right, so that was the Quarter to Three podcast this week. JT, thank you for hanging out with us. That was very cool of you to join us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so don't get Rage. I am Tom Chick. I've been joined by Jason R. McMaster. Jason R. McMaster, what does the R stand for?
Rage!
Screw up! But it didn't do her no good, 'cause she's just a sum of her influence, and I can't tell you the difference by the cracked windscreen on her car. Something is telling you how lucky you are. You're just like the rest of those girls. They're all dead by diamonds and dead by diamonds and dead by diamonds.